Beruchim Abayim, ladies. We're studying Parashat Shemot. Actually, we started a new sefer this week, a new book, the second sefer of the Torah. The Ramban calls this book that we're reading, Sefer Shemot, he calls it Sefer HaGe'ula, the book of redemption, because it talks about the exodus of the Jewish people that left Egypt. They were freed. That's a Ge'ula. And it also at the end talks about the construction of the Mishkan, which is the tabernacle, which is the portable Beit HaMikdash that they built in the Midbar. That's a spiritual redemption. So the book is filled with different types of spiritual and physical redemption. Hence, Sefer HaGe'ula. Right in the beginning of the Perasha, it tells us that the exile began with 70 people that moved from the land of Canaan down to Egypt. And I want to point out something here. Yaakov Avinu and his family lived in Israel. And there was a great famine in Israel. And as a result of the famine, they were forced to leave. And they went to a place where there was food, and that was Egypt. And as a result of that, they found themselves in Egypt, and God engineered that. So when the exile starts, they're there already. That's how God transported the Jews from one area in the Middle East to another area, through a famine. Our rabbis tell us from here that everything happens in the world because of the Jewish people. Whether you believe it, whether you don't believe it, whether you see it, whether you don't see it, anything and everything that's happening in the world somehow is to affect the Jewish people. Now, who would believe at that time, 2,000 years ago, if somebody would have said in Canaan, this famine over here is because of the Jews? What do the Jews have to do with it? There were only 70 Jews in the world. You have who knows how many thousands of people, and the only Jews living was Yaakov Avinu and his family. But in retrospect, when you look back, why did the famine happen in the land of Canaan? It happened because of the Jews. In order to transport them to Mitzrayim, in order to enable the exile to start. So it is a true statement that everything that happens in the world has a direct effect on the Jewish cause. Torah tells us that Vayamot Yosef dies, Ubnei Yisrael paru vayishritzu, and the Jewish people multiplied. Hachamim tell us that the ladies were giving birth six at a time, six tuplets, and this was without fertility, this was happening naturally. Vayakom melech hadash al Mitzrayim, and a new king arose on Egypt. Asher lo yadat Yosef, that didn't know Yosef. And our rabbis are very puzzled. Is it possible that there was a king that rose upon Egypt that didn't know of Yosef? Yosef was famous. Yosef was the king. Yosef was the viceroy. Yosef was the man that supplied food for the whole entire Egypt. Yosef saved Egypt from bankruptcy. Is it possible that there can be an Egyptian living at that time that doesn't know who Yosef is? What does it mean? A new king arose on Egypt that didn't know Yosef. So Hachamim tell us that he did away with a policy that Yosef instituted. That's what it is. He didn't know Yosef. He didn't respect his policy. Which policy was that? Yosef demanded that every Egyptian must circumcise himself. Yeah, you know it or not, last week's parashah, am I right? I'm right, okay. The committee says I'm right. Last week, 2 weeks ago, we learned that Yosef HaSadiq, he made four circumcision. Now the Hachamim give a reason to this. Since there was a famine, so Yosef wanted to curb the population. He wanted to limit how many people are born into a famine-stricken society. So causing them to do Brit Milah would be a form of limiting themselves. However, when Paro saw that it wasn't working, because the Jewish people who also have Brit Milah were multiplying six at a time. So he says, what is this worth, this Gizirav? The whole purpose of Gizirav, no Brit Milah, was to limit the population. But look at the population. It's becoming multiplied by leaps and bounds. So he said, that's it. The Egyptian population, you do not have to take Brit Milah anymore. Now, you say, big deal. But this was a very big deal. Because we're going to read later in the Perasha, when Moshe Rabbeinu was born, and he's placed in a little teban, a little ark, and his mother and sister, they place him in the Nile, and he's floating in the Nile, and the daughter of Paro, she's going down to the Nile to take a swim, and she sees the basket, and she opens the basket, and right away she says, this is a Jewish child. How did she know it was a Jewish child? So Hachamim tells us, because she saw that he had a Brit Milah. Now, if everybody was having a Brit Milah in Egypt, then there should be really no way for her to know if the child was Jewish or not. So as a result of Paro doing away with that rule of mandatory circumcision, therefore everybody in Egypt became uncircumcised except the Jews. Hence, the daughter of Paro recognized immediately that Moshe was Jewish. And what's the benefit of that? Because it says she went to search for a Jewish family in order to raise the child. So you see, Borei Olam already masters everything, that even a gezerah like that benefited the Jewish people. Now, it goes without saying that Paro's whole decree to limit the population by killing the children, and rabbis tell us he saw in the stars. He was a stargazer. He was an astrologer. They say he looked up in his stars and he saw that the Jewish Redeemer is going to be born. He saw that the ultimate redemption is going to be through a boy that's going to be born soon. So he said he has a plan. He'll kill all the boys. And he'll kill the Redeemer also. But look at the irony over here. You can't outsmart God. Not only didn't he kill the Redeemer, but at the end of the day, his daughter saved the Redeemer as a result of his decree. And where was Moshe Rabbeinu raised? In the palace of Paro. That means Paro fed him. Paro, he put him in a crib, he took care of him, he raised him, he gave him an allowance. So Moshe Rabbeinu, that's who Paro was going after this whole time. The whole reason why I made the decree is to rid Moshe. And Borei Olam says, you're playing games with me? You think you're going to outsmart me? You think you're going to outmaneuver me? You think you're going to stop my will from coming true? Not only are you going to fail, but you're going to be the one that saves Moshe. We see this in history many times. You remember the story of Haman. We read it on Purim. You know, Haman did everything in order to kill his nemesis, Mordechai. He even went and built a tall gallows. And he went to Ahasuerus and he told the king, he was about to tell the king, we have to hang Mordechai on the tree. And at the end of the day, who got hung on the tree? His whole plan backfired, and he ended up getting hung on the tree that he built for Mordechai, which means you can't outsmart God. Sometimes the enemies themselves, they bring their own destruction. And that's what we say in the Haggadah of Pesach. We say, V'hakadosh Baruch Hu matzilenu miyadam. God always saves us from their hands. But one rabbi said, God saves us using their hands, meaning miyadam. They themselves bring the redemption. Paro, his hands, brought the redemption. Haman, he built the gallows, miyadam. From their hands themselves, they deliver the Jewish people. Torah tells us that the midwives that used to deliver the Jewish children, they were called Shifra and Pu'ah. Who were Shifra and Pu'ah? Chamim tell us that they were actually Yocheved and Miriam. Yocheved is Moshe Rabbeinu's mother. Miriam is Moshe Rabbeinu's sister. Besides being great ladies, they were also midwives. They would go from house to house, from home to home, and they would coach the ladies when they were delivering. And the Torah tells us she was called Shifra, that was a nickname. Where does the word shifra come from? From the Hebrew word leshaper, to beautify. You see, a good midwife, when the child is born, is able to beautify the child's shape of his body. For example, the Gemara tells a story once that somebody asked a great rabbi, why are all the children in Iraq, in Babel, they all have round heads? So Hillel answered the question. You know what Hillel answered? Hillel says, because they don't have good midwives. Because when the baby comes out, the job of a midwife is to shape the body. The body of the baby is soft still. It's still, you could maneuver it. You could play with the limbs. So therefore, they're very inexperienced. So they make one the same shape. Everyone has a head like a basketball. So he says, the mialedot, they were called shifra. She was called shifra because she was able to beautify the child. It says the limbs also. When the child is young, if the midwife is able to put all the limbs in order, it'll save a child from problems, bar minan, later on. Her sister was called pu'ah. Why do they call her pu'ah? So the hakamim say pu'ah is a play on the words poo, 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 ah, ah, ah. Because that's what she used to do to the children. She used to coo them. She used to talk to them. She used to make sounds to them. Poo, 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 to make the child laugh and make them happy. So I saw one rabbi make a very important point. That's the nickname you give these ladies? They were much greater than this. I mean, these ladies put their lives on the line. They defied the king. The king said, kill all the children. And they went out against the king and they gave the children life. They risked themselves. They had tremendous fear of God. And that's the greatest name you can call them? You call them poo, poo, poo and shifra because they beautify the child. It's a nice thing, don't get me wrong. But why is that the focus of the Torah? Why does that become their name? And Achamim learned from here a great lesson. That great people, across the board, great people are not judged in life by the great things that they did. Great people are usually judged on the small things that they did, on the little things that they did. Because the great things in life, everybody's able to rise to the occasion once or twice in their life and do a great thing. To head a project, to run a charity for a little while. Everybody in their life has patience and tolerance for a major undertaking once or twice. But to do something every single day, the consistency of it, this is very difficult. And that tells the true character of a person. Remember that. You'll be judged at the end of the day after 120 on the small things. Motherhood, and we never underestimate motherhood and that career of raising children, that might be looked at as, you know, a small thing. What do you do? I raise my children. Although it might be looked upon as a small thing, but it's something that you do every day. The fact that you have to put them on a bus and take them off a bus, and you have to cook dinner, and you have to help them with their homework, and you have to drive them here and take them there, and the dentists and the doctors, and all those little acts, they'll never make the front page of the newspaper. You're never going to get awarded as, you know, with a trophy. Your late mother took a baby to the doctor. But those small things, since they happen so often, and they happen so consistent, so daily, that is what makes a person great. Shifra and pu'ah. Their greatness was not merely that they saved children. Amongst their greatness, they still had the little things. Coo, 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 ah, ah, ah. Those things, the Torah, that's their greatness. The details, the small things in life. There was a lady, she was called Deborah. Deborah was a leader of Israel. She was a prophetess. Not too many ladies reached the level of Deborah. And the Navi, when it's talking about Deborah, you know what that means? She led Israel. She was like the king. She was in charge. She reached the level of prophecy. What does it mean to reach a level of prophecy? But the Navi tells us she was called Deborah Eshet Lapidot. The lady that made wicks for the Beit HaMikdash. Every day she had a little room in her house. She would take the cotton and she would make the wicks. And then she'd go to the Beit HaMikdash and she'd give the Kohanim the wicks so they could use it to light the menorah. That's what you call her? She's a prophetess. She's talking to God. She's leading a nation. She's doing the most heroic things. But the Torah says her greatness was not only on the big things that she did. The fact that she took a few minutes every day to make wicks and give it to the Beit HaMikdash, and she did it before she was a prophetess, she did it while she was a prophetess, that already becomes her greatness. Following that, the Torah tells us about how Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Pasuk says, "Vayelech ish mi bet Levi, vayikach et bat Levi." There was a fellow from the tribe of Levi. Doesn't tell us his name. Vayikach et bat Levi. He married a lady from his tribe. Doesn't tell us her name. Vatayra isha. The lady gives birth. Vatelet ben, and they have a son. Now we know who this is. This is Amram and Yocheved. So why doesn't it mention their names? Don't you think they deserve honorable mention? After all, they're the parents of Moshe Rabbeinu. Why should they have an anonymous mention in the Torah? So I saw two explanations I'd like to share with you today. In this week's Perasha, we read about the birth of Moshe. To have a child does not really tell us anything about who the parents are. Anybody can have a child. Go look what goes on in the world today. There being children born, teenage pregnancy, God forbid, and all sorts of other illegal forms and immoral forms of bringing. To bring children, anybody can bring children. There's no wisdom. A parent cannot get credit that he had a child. When can the parent get credit? When the child gets older, when the child develops, and he becomes an exemplary citizen, and he becomes a role model, and he becomes a person of decency, then already we can go back and say, okay, who were those parents? So at this point, the Torah is telling us, when he was born, we're not going to mention the parents, because it's not worthy. They don't deserve any credit. But did they have a child? Allah Baruch, anybody can have a child. Later on in the Perasha, when we see who Moshe Rabbeinu grew up to be, who does the credit go to? Then the Torah mentions his father's name was Amram, and his mother's name was Yocheved. A parent's compliment is on hold. The parent is not complimented until the child develops and makes his mark on society. Now the Torah will go back and say, your name could be mentioned. But here where it's just saying they were born, being born is not a credit. But I saw another explanation today. And it's quite comforting, this explanation. Moshe Rabbeinu became probably or definitely, certainly the greatest man that ever lived. He excelled in everything. He went up to God for 40 days and 40 nights. He received the Torah. He was the Redeemer. What didn't he do? You might say to yourself, as great as he became in Torah, must have been because he had great parents. And as a result of his great parents, that made him Moshe. And the Torah is coming to tell us, Torah is not an inheritance. It doesn't matter who your parents are. They were anonymous. There was a man from Levi, took a lady from Levi. What's their names? Doesn't matter. Don't think that for your children to excel in the study of Torah, that you yourselves have to be some sort of tzaddikim, hasidim, righteous, lofty, on a different level. The Torah is telling us Torah in your children is free for the taking. It doesn't matter where the child came from. He came from anonymous parents. Now that's not true in everything else in life. If your children want to be kohanim, it depends who the parents are. The parents have to be kohanim. If your children want to be Levi'im in life, the parents have to be Levi'im. If your children want to be kings in life, the family has to come from the king family, the dynasty. But there's only one thing in life that doesn't demand a pedigree, that doesn't demand lineage, and that is excellence in Torah. So therefore, every parent is able to be comforted and say, my child also can become as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. And no one should say, for me, look at my level, look what we do, look what we're going to have a son like Moshe. For that reason, the Torah says there was an anonymous man that married an anonymous lady, and they had a child. And for that, the Torah tells us that there's hope for every single parent, no matter what religious level that they're on, that they too can have great children as Moshe. But to me, the whole thing is extra. And Torah tells us there was a fellow from the house of Levi, and he got married, and he had a child. It's too... We know how to have children. What are you telling me over here? Just tell me. Moshe was born. What does the Torah have to elaborate? You think every time somebody was born in the Torah goes to great length and says, there was a man, he married a lady, they had a child, it's too teil, it's too long, it's too much. Just tell me, Moshe Rabbeinu was born. We know he's born from parents. Anybody could have doubt that he was born from parents? Where was he born from? What do you have to tell me about the marriage and the history? So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says a beautiful answer. Because the Torah is telling us the greatest leader, the greatest man, the most saintly Jew, the most godly person that ever exists. You know where he came from? He was born from parents. Because there is a religion in this world that claims that their holiest man was created from an immaculate conception. To the Goyim, they come along and say, it's impossible. Can greatness come from a mother and a father? They're human beings. They're mortals. How can a mortal human being? So nobody should make a mistake and think that Moshe was some sort of creation that was out of the normal. And nobody should think that Moshe Rabbeinu was created somehow, Chas v'Shalom, like the Goyim say, son of God, and all that type of stuff. So the Torah comes at great lengths to tell us, there was a man, a specific man over here, and there was a lady, and they got married like everybody else gets married in the normal way, and they had a child in the normal way like everybody else, to dispel any types of thinkings of immaculate conception or things like that. Torah continues and tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu grew up, and as he grew up, he was very compassionate to his brethren, to the Jewish people. One of the things it says is he was out one day and he saw some people fighting. He saw an Egyptian actually beating up a Jew. Moshe Rabbeinu looked both ways. He didn't see anybody around. And he struck the Egyptian and he killed him. Hachamim tell us he didn't really hit him. He actually used one of the magical names of God. And he said it in front of him. And he dropped dead. And he buried him. Happened to be there was some Jews that saw what happened. Those Jews were called Datan v'Aviram. And they went to Paro. And they told Paro, listen, Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, the prince, your son, whatever you call him, he's killing Egyptians. And Paro wanted to kill Moshe. The rabbis tell us he actually took a shot at him and miracle happened. But Moshe Rabbeinu, as a result of that, had to run away. This is the first encounter that Moshe had with these troublemakers, Datan v'Aviram. And we're going to soon see how these two guys, they bothered Moshe his whole life. They were his biggest critics. They were the ones that always defied Moshe. They know he's Jewish. So what are you getting him in trouble for? The biggest avon in the world, to go to the government and start telling on another Jew? We pray for these people to die three times a day. Laminim v'lamalshinim, the informers. And they went to the government, they got Moshe in trouble. Well, was it over? When Moshe Rabbeinu comes back years later to redeem the Jewish people, the second he comes to Paro, Paro was very upset. He says, not only am I not letting the Jews out, but now they're going to have to fetch their own straw to make the bricks. Till now, the government provided the straw. And the Jews had to make a certain quota of bricks. Once Moshe came on the scene, it became dramatically worse. Not only do you have to make the million bricks a day, but you have to go get your own straw. It seems Moshe Rabbeinu made things worse. So, of course, who's the first critic against Moshe? Datan v'Aviram, the true bubble troublemakers. You're here again, Moshe? Again, you're making trouble for us? Yesterday, Paro liked us. At least the decree was the decree. But now you came on the scene, you made it worse, you're jeopardizing us. Who put you in charge? Go back to where you came from. Again, troublemakers. The Jewish people come out of Egypt. Talking now, fast forward. They're in the desert. They have man, the magical bread that's falling from the heaven. Moshe gets up and says, Rabotai, do not leave over the man. Which means, eat everything for today. Do not leave it over for tomorrow morning. Don't store the man. Don't leave any leftovers till tomorrow morning. Sure enough, two guys come along, and they leave over. And the rabbis tell us how it turned wormy and so on. The Torah tells us. Who were these people that left over to find Moshe? Datan v'Aviram again. And then the Torah tells us when there was a rebellion against Moshe with Korach. Korach eventually got swallowed underneath the ground because he rebelled against Moshe. But who was Korach's partners in this mutiny against Moshe? Datan v'Aviram. So the rabbis ask an obvious question. God, you love Moshe. His Sadiq. Why are you letting him get harassed by these two gangsters? Why even take them out of Egypt? I mean, there were a lot of Jews that didn't make it out of Egypt. Datan v'Aviram should have died in Egypt. Why does God allow Datan v'Aviram constantly to irk Moshe, to vex him, to contradict him, to criticize him? And the explanation the Hachamim say is because they serve the great purpose. They prove to us the authenticity of Moshe. Because somebody might say, yeah, well, Moshe Rabbeinu, who's to say all these things were true about him? You know, maybe the Jews were under some type of spell. Maybe he mesmerized them. You know, maybe they were all gurus, everybody following him like, you know, like this, with their hands, you know, brainwashed. And who knows what Moshe Rabbeinu was? So the Torah goes out of its way and says, now you should know that there were a lot of critics, or at least two famous critics there. And if Moshe did anything out of line, trust me, you'd hear it from these two guys. So the worst things that they said, the Torah tells us. But you don't hear them, committed adultery, you killed innocent people. You need these two troublemakers to give an authenticity to Moshe Rabbeinu. To show that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do anything out of the ordinary. And the truth is, they proved to us that the Torah was given at Sinai. Because you never hear Datan v'Aviram tell Moshe, who said that you got the Torah? Who said God? That they didn't contradict. So on all the things that they agreed with, if Datan v'Aviram agreed, it must be it's true. Because they were looking to needle Moshe on anything. So from what they didn't complain on, must tell us, it was true beyond a shadow of a doubt. So from the naysayers, you see exactly who Moshe Rabbeinu was. Now, Paro, if we could talk about him for a second, he commissioned the Jewish people to build him cities. Two of the famous cities that the Jews built were called Pitom and Ramses. The Gemara says something very strange about these two cities. The Gemara says they were built on quicksand. And every time they would build a city, the ground, the weight of the city would cause it to collapse, and we get swallowed underneath the ground, so to speak, and then have to start from scratch again. And Rav Pam, Alav Shalom, asked the obvious question. Hey, Paro, you're a smart guy. You have millions of Jews working for you. Let them do something productive. You make them build on quicksand, well, you know the city's not going to last again, so they're building the same city 100 times over and over again. I mean, go look at the pyramids in Egypt. That's one of the seven wonders of the world. Unbelievable. Let the Jews, million Jews, let them go build some structures like that where Egypt can brag and boast. Look at the architecture. Look at the building. But to build on quicksand, what was Paro thinking? It's a waste of work. It's a waste of time for him. So Rav Pam says this shows us how evil Paro was. Not only did he physically torture the Jewish people, but he psychologically tortured us. Because even the worst worker, that has to do terrible back-breaking labor, there's one thing that gives him comfort. And that is, at the end of the day, he did something. At the end of the day, he could walk proudly and say, I built that building. Okay, killed me. I got my broken back. I sweat. Almost died. But at the end of the day, there's something to show for it. There's a certain amount of good feeling that you produce something. You know it yourselves. Person works, whether it's cooking or whether it's sewing or needle pointing, something, after the hard work, you have something to show for it. Say, look, there's a feeling of accomplishment. But there's nothing more torturous psychologically than to build something and to invest your energies in something to know that in a few days it's not going to be there anymore. This is mind games. This is playing on the psyche of the Jewish people to drive them insane. You know, they tell stories about the tortures that they used to have in Siberia. One of the tortures used to be they used to put a person in a room in solitary confinement for 15 years. That itself can drive a person crazy, solitary confinement, no windows. And they would put him on a bicycle, and they would tell him to ride it. And they would explain to him that behind this wall, there's acres and acres of wheat fields. And by you treading on this bicycle, you're actually grinding wheat to make it into flour in order to feed the starving Russians. And the fellow would get up early in the morning and he'd be pounding on the bicycle. And in his mind, he's thinking that children are eating hot cereal as a result of his work. And that people are able to have bread, and people are able to have food, and the peasants are being fed. So at least there's something good coming out of his work. And after 15 years, the ruthless Russians would take the man and say, you're free to go now, but we want to show you something. And they bring him on the other side of the wall, and there's nothing there. And he thinks for a moment that for 15 years, he was riding a bicycle. He did nothing. That was a psychological torture. They would collapse. They would have nervous breakdowns. How could you live with yourself? You wasted all that time. Show me. At least have nothing to show for it. It's nothing. It's a waste. And that's exactly what Paro did, to show you the ruthless behavior. When you think of Paro, you have to think of Hitler. It's the same mentality. It's the same ruthlessness. And that's why he had an intent. He didn't care about quicksand. He didn't care about building up Egypt. He was more concerned about breaking the Jewish spirit. That was what Paro was thinking. Torah then tells us, as we go, Moshe sees the burning bush. And God tells Moshe at the burning bush, you're nominated to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. And then Moshe Rabbeinu gets into a whole dialogue with God. And he starts telling God, listen, I'm going to get there. How are they going to believe me? I'm going to say I'm the Mashiach, I'm the Redeemer. They're going to say, who says? You know, I got to know. What if they don't trust me? And God answers him back, tell them this, tell them that. And then Moshe Rabbeinu says, but maybe I'm not the guy to do it. My older brother, Aharon, maybe he should be the one. And Moshe Rabbeinu is giving a whole back and forth. And all our rabbis ask the same question. What gives Moshe Rabbeinu a right to start questioning? And God told you to go do it, go do it. What do you mean? You're going to start questioning now? You want to understand it also? Whether you understand it or not, I'm telling you to go redeem the Jewish people. What allows Moshe to debate the subject? Or to even question the subject? A similar question is found by Avraham Avinu. God tells Avraham, I'm going to destroy the city of Sodom. Okay. What does Avraham do? How could you do it? It's not fair. You're going to kill innocent people. They don't deserve it. Is this justice? Maybe there's 50 tzaddikim. Maybe there's 45. It's not. Let's make a deal over here. God told you he's destroying it. So what allows Avraham to start negotiating, to start making deals? And the explanation is said as follows. The explanation is said God is beyond us. God's wisdom surely surpasses the limited, finite human intelligence. It's really impossible to try to make sense of what God does, unless God allows you to question. If He allows you to question, then you're allowed to analyze. Where do we see in this story that God allowed Moshe to understand what he was supposed to do? The Pasuk writes, and I quote, Va'ered lehatzilo miyad Misraim. God says, I have come down, I shall descend to rescue the people. What does it mean, I shall descend? God was telling Moshe, I am descending to your level, meaning you have a right to understand it and ask questions. From the word va'ered. Va'ered doesn't necessarily mean God came down from heaven to take the Jews out. He could do that from upstairs also. He has to come down. God can run the world from heaven. He doesn't need to come down. The explanation is when it says he came down, that means he was telling Moshe, I'm coming down to human intelligence, which means you can understand what I'm doing. So Moshe says, fine, you're coming down, I'm going to ask questions. What if this happens? What if that happens? The same pasuk is written by Sedom. God says, Erdana ve'ereh. I'm going to descend and look down what's going on Sedom. So Abraham says, oh, you're descending to my level? Good, I want to ask you a question then. What are you doing? Sadiq, Rasha, 50, 40. And that same word, vayered, that God descended, was used when God gave the Torah. Vayered Hashem al Har Sinai. God descended to Har Sinai. You know what that tells us, ladies? A very important lesson now. That you're allowed to question the Torah. That you're allowed to understand it. God didn't want a law to be given where you just have to accept it without understanding why you're doing it. God wanted the Torah to be deciphered and questioned and answered. What do you think the Hachamim do in the Kollelim all day long? They're back and forth. Why does it say this word? No, it doesn't mean this. No, it means that. Yes, it does. What's the question? What's the... What gives you a right to debate the word of God? Because the Pasuk says, Vayered. God descended to give the Torah, to tell us that He's giving it, that it should be understood according to human intelligence. That is not to say that if we don't understand something, we don't do it. But it means you have a right to analyze. You thought you had a heter now to say, you thought you had a loophole now to forget about half the Torah, because we don't understand more than half of it. In any event, the Torah is telling us you have a right at least to analyze it as far as you can go. Lastly, I saw a thought towards the end of the Perasha. At the end of the Perasha, we read about how the Jewish people weren't able to fill the quotas of bricks, obviously. It's too much work for them. Between collecting the straw and making the bricks, how many hours are there in the day? I mean, they were working for 19 hours a day as it is. And they were barely making the quota of bricks. Now they have to, in those 19 hours, collect straw and make the same quota. I mean, it's an impossibility. So it says they weren't able to do it. And the Jewish people had managers over them. Jewish managers. Very good. Those Jewish managers were called shotrim. In Hebrew today, they call them shotrim as a policeman. But it's more, in the Torah, it meant an officer. They were like Bermanan in Germany. It was the same thing. Hitler put some Jews in charge of overseeing the concentration camps. And they had to report back to the Gestapo with productivity reports. The shotrim. So the Torah tells us that as the Jewish people weren't able to make their quota, so the shotrim were getting beaten. They're responsible. So it says the shotrim came to Paro and they complained. What did they tell Paro? So the pasuk says, Lama ta'ase kol avadecha? Paro, what are you doing? Why are you putting us through this agony Kevin en nitan avadecha. You're not providing us with the raw materials. Ulbenim omrim lanu asu. But you're still telling us to make the same amount of bricks. Bine avadecha mukim. And we're getting beaten as, on account of this. Vehatat amecha. This is a sin for you. How will the rabbi say, what do you mean it's a sin? Hey, Paro cares about a sin? Paro for 210 years is committing the worst, the heinous crimes. He don't care, sin, not sin. What do you mean, vatat amicha? This is a sin. This is a stain on your reputation. This is a sin to your people. So I saw two explanations. Rav Shimon Schwab says. He says like this. Paro, what goes around comes around. We're getting punished over here. We're getting beaten because you're asking us to do the impossible. It is impossible. There's no way we can make the same amount of bricks. So you're punishing us for something that can't be done. They were telling Paro, that sin of getting punished for something that's beyond your capability is going to come and haunt you one day. When was that? When the plagues came on Egypt. Our rabbis tell us that God stiffened Paro's heart. God made it that Paro will not let the Jewish people go. He was forced. Even if he wanted to let us go as a result of the plague, God stiffened his heart. So he had no choice. It was impossible for him. But what happened to Paro? God still punished him. Why does Paro get punished for something that he wasn't able to do? Because he put the Jewish people in the same situation. It was impossible to make the same bricks. So why are you punishing us? You're punishing me for something that I can't do? God says you will get punished also one day for something that you won't be able to do. Vehatat amecha. This sin that you're doing one day is going to come and bite you. Brilliant explanation. But he says one more pshat, which is more down to earth, more simple. He says, this decree is not going to serve you well as king of Egypt, because we're defying you. Not that we want to defy you, but just we can't. We have no choice. There's no way to make bricks and collect the straw on the same day. It's impossible. But you know what's happening, Paro? It's becoming clear to the Egyptian society that we're in defiance of you and we're not following the law. Why would you want to create a situation where Egyptian law is being broken? What's going to end up happening? That attitude is going to permeate throughout the society. When one group of society repeatedly offends and breaks the law, it's going to trickle down to the rest of society. And the other Egyptians might say, well, look at the Jews, they don't listen to Paro. I mean, he's telling them to make certain breaks and all, they're not doing it. So what do we have to keep Egyptian law for? So they were coming and telling them from a government standpoint. V'hatat amecha. Forget about us. Worry about the sins of your people. Your people are going to learn from this. You're giving us no choice but to break the law. And when people see other citizens breaking the law, they themselves will become more prone to break the law. So you're ruining your government. You're ruining the society. It's not good for you. It's not good for your people. Of course, Paro is deaf and dumb and everything else to all these logical claims that were told to him, and he doesn't repeal the decree. Moshe Rabbeinu comes at the end of the parasha and tells God, what's happening? God, it's too much already. You told me to come redeem the Jewish people, and not only am I not redeeming them, but you made it worse. What's happening? And God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, now you'll see what's going to happen. At that point, God agreed to Moshe and said, fine, it's reached its lowest point. Now I'm going to begin the redemption. So the table is set, ladies, for next week. in order, it's okay, 2 o'clock the phones can go off. It's after the time, you see I'm not even getting nervous. After 2 o'clock, it's my fault. Before that, it's a different story. Next week we discuss exactly how God manifested it and saved the Jewish people from Egypt. Baruch Adonai, Amen, Amen.